The Common and the Production of Architecture, Early Hypotheses, by Pier Vittorio Orelli. And this is from a book called Common Ground from the Venice Biennale in 2012. Architecture is not only what is built. Architecture is a shared knowledge out of which every architectural project and every building is made. While in ancient times this shared knowledge was embedded directly in the practice of building physical artifacts, since the 15th century, architectural knowledge has taken the form of the project. Practicing the project means to put forward something that does not yet exist. This act of anticipation has taken the form of all those means, plans, drawings, images, texts that are necessary in order to construct the vision of a reality yet to come. It is exactly as an act of anticipation that the project is also a reality in itself, whose importance is often independent from its eventual realization. The project is the conditio sine qua non of the production of architecture. It gives form and reproduces a shared and thus collective knowledge which is irreducible to what is realized in the form of buildings and design objects. This collective knowledge that any architectural project always implies can be defined as the common in architecture. Traditionally, the common are the commons, resources that are owned collectively and for this reason could not be made private property. The commons of water, rivers, forests, etc. But a very important kind of commons is knowledge, the product of shared and collective intelligence that allows a multitude to cooperate and work together. What we traditionally understand as, quote, the discipline of architecture, that is, a body of knowledge made of experiences, historical examples, design and building techniques, ways to understand space and form, is not the product of a few talented geniuses, but it is always collectively produced. Architecture can only exist as a shared and thus common knowledge. It is not difficult to understand how the common becomes decisive within the production of architecture. To develop an architectural project means to use and reproduce forms, traditions, codes, examples, and ways of perceiving and understanding space. For this reason, architecture, understood as a body of knowledge and as a discipline, cannot be idealized or withdrawn into an exclusive space freed from political and economic constraints. On the contrary, today it is precisely the, quote, discipline of architecture, this collective knowledge implied by every single architectural project that is exploited and appropriated by capital. Within post-Fordism, those spheres that were once outside economy, such as imagination, effects, and information, have become primary means of production. Moreover, production, especially production of knowledge, emphasizes cooperation as the fundamental modus operandi of our society. Within the production of architecture, this is more than evident. Every architectural project is made through collaboration between different actors who constantly rely on knowledge that is always collectively produced. And yet this reality of the architectural project clashes with the way the production of architecture is represented through the signature of individual authors. The common is thus fragmented by the proliferation of styles, identities, and authorships that project the aura of uniqueness for everything being produced. This situation becomes critical, especially in the way the production of architecture is communicated in exhibitions and publications. In this way, the common is reduced to the point of convergence of individualities, which appear as resolutely different from one another. Against this reality, we have to remember that the common is not the meeting point of different individualities, but the pre-individual basis for production that emerges as a singular form anytime individual actions take place. To think the common ground in architecture, not as uniforming framework, like the concept of universality, but as a pre-individual reality that informs any singular gesture, requires an understanding of what the philosopher Paolo Virno has defined as the relationship between what is maximally common and what is maximally singular. Virno refers to a situation in which a particular speaker whose statements have provoked our approval or irritation differs from all those who have taken the floor before or after him. Yet this speaker is different precisely because its speech reveals a common nature with them, the faculty of language. According to Virno, the capacity for articulating signifying sounds, a biological prerequisite of the Homo sapiens, cannot manifest itself other than by being individuated in a plurality of speakers. Inversely, such plurality of speakers would be inconceivable without the preliminary participation of each and every one of them in that pre-individual reality, which is precisely the capacity for articulating signifying sounds. In this process, a historically determined reality gives rise to an extraordinary process of diversification of experience and practice. As Virno argues, quote, "Far from cancelling each other out, the common and the singular refer back to one another in a kind of vicious circle." Following Duns Scotus and Gilbert Simondon, Virno affirms that the relationship between the common and the singular can be explained as the relationship between potentiality and actuality. Potentiality is the infinite range of possibilities not yet determined into finite things, the historically determined reality of the possible. Actuality is a determination of what is potential in the form of finite things and events. What is important to stress is that what is actualized, an event, an object, a person, can never exhaust the range of possibilities offered by what is potential. In other words, what is determined, the individuated individual, does not in itself encapsulate the potential infinity inherent in what is common. At the same time, the individuate individual, the singular, is not the residue of an infinite sequence of oppositions and delimitations. Being the actualization of what is potential, the singular always remains within the common. For this reason, the common, meant as the pre-individual, is in radical contrast with the category of the universal. As Virno argues, the universal is a nominalist category. It is a product of verbal thought which abstracts certain characteristics that uniformly recur in already individuated entities. The common, instead, is a realist category because it addresses the pre-individual reality that makes communication between individuals possible. To make the common explicit means to theorize architecture not as the product of individual contributions, but as a collective force, as a pre-individual reality that is both the productive basis of architectural production, but also something autonomous, something that exceeds its technical and commercial determinations and which addresses and manifests our collective understanding of the space in which we live. Looking back over the history of architecture, it is not difficult to find attempts to define the common in architecture. Here I would like to put forward two examples. It is possible to affirm that the French architect and theorist Claude Perrault was the first theorist to offer a theory of architecture that emphasized the common. Perrault's treatise on the Five Orders, published in 1683, can be understood as a theory that has profound implications for the relationship between architectural language and its pre-individual's social dimension. As is well known in the famous Querelle des Anciens et des Modernes that placed Perrault in opposition opposition to the defenders of Vitruvian architecture. Perrault affirmed that it was not possible to associate the grammar of the five orders to the imitation of nature, and thus it was not possible to refer to the transcendental to a transcendental principle. For example, Perrault noted that the theorists that define the proportions of the five orders could not agree on a universal standard, and each of them proposed a different interpretation. This led Perrault to the conclusion that beauty of proportions does not derive from some universal a priori, but is the product of shared customs and habits. As Perrault concluded, quote, any architecture has no proportions true in themselves. It remains to be seen whether we can establish those that are probable and likely founded upon convincing reason, without departure too far from proportions usually received. End quote. What is crucial to understand is that within Perrault's theory, the production of architectural form is a process of actualization of common pre-individual potential made by the customs, the habits, the knowledge of a specific historical time. With Perrault, architectural language for the first time is understood not as imitation of nature, but as an arbitrary system of science whose evolution responds to the ethos, the modes of sociality in any given period. Another theoretical contribution that can be interpreted as an attempt to define the common in architectural language are the urban studies developed by Aldo Rossi between 1956 and 76. From the publication of his first important study on the transformations of the city of Milan at the beginning of the 19th century to his unfinished project, the Città Analoga. What characterized Rossi's research is the fact that it was focused on the whole city and not just on authored architecture. Rossi explored all kinds of urban conditions that were accessible to him in Italy and Europe between the 1950s and the 1960s, from the city centre to the post-war periphery to other emerging urban formations such as the new 1960s suburbs. At the beginning of the 1960s, Rossi searched for a methodology that would help him systematize this knowledge and resurrect the concept of typology. Rossi believed that such a concept would allow him to avoid both the reduction of architecture to the individual contributions of the quote great masters and the technocratic universalism of late modern architecture. In his work of on typology, Rossi found inspiration in Quotmeyer de Quincey's definition of type. For Quotmeyer, type is not a model to be mechanically copied, but the idea that gives origin to a manifold of objects or buildings. Therefore, a type cannot be imitated, but only actualized into tangible forms. Yet Quatremier defined type in universalistic and essentialist terms when he stressed the fact that type is an a priori principle, quote, a kind of nucleus around which the developments and variations of forms to which the object is susceptible gather and mesh. End quote. Though Rossi was clearly influenced by Quatremier's definition, his theory of type is slightly different. For Rossi, type does not reveal a nucleus or the origin of something, but it is simply the potential of a structuring principle. Such a structuring principle depends upon the social and political conditions of a particular place in a particular time. For this reason, type, which is a historically and thus politically determined reality, becomes tangible only through what Rossi identifies as the singularity of the urban artifact. And yet, just like what is common and thus potential cannot be exhausted in the singularity, no type can be identified with only one form. Quote, even if all architectural forms are reducible to a type. End quote. The urban artifact is thus the singularity that actualizes the type. While type remains the common, the summation of all social habits and customs understood as a structuring principle. In Rossi's terms, typology, the discourse on type, is thus not what is commonly understood as a particular building type, but is instead the analytical moment of architecture, the conceptual framework that allows us to understand an urban artifact as the tangible expression of a much wider and inexhaustible domain. This domain is the historically determined common, the sharing of habits, customs, ideas, that allows a multitude of individuals to exist and to which Rossi never assigned a preconceived form. On the other hand, Rossi identified this common in the finite terms of architecture by assuming the urban artifact as its tangible actualization. In Rossi's theory, form becomes what for Virenoux, following Scoto, is the principium individuationis, the process of actualization of what is potential. It is for this reason that Rossi theorized the urban artifact through the individuality of the locus, that is, the place as a finite, limited, singular form. Against the organicist, ecologically orientated theories of design, which were very popular in the 1960s and which focused on the possibility of dissolving architectural form within the continuum of urban space, Rossi postulated the urban artifact as a singular event which does not exhaust the potential of the city. It is instead just a mark of the city, resolutely different from anything else and whose difference is made possible by belonging to its common, to the structuring dynamism of the city itself. As we have already said, post-Fordism is a mode of production that puts to work all the faculties that characterize the human animal, such as language, imagination, and affect. Here it is important to insist on the fact that while a building or any other product design is a defined finite form, its process of production and its use is a reality that cannot be reduced to a single object or to the authorship of one single office or person. If the project is always a gesture in a social space, this gesture is nevertheless rooted in knowledge, which is by definition collectively produced. This reality is at odds with the emphasis on individual identities and authorships claimed by individual architects and officers, but also and especially with the increasingly precarious conditions of the multitude of who produce architecture behind the facade of individual signatures. What is increasingly shocking is the regime of scarcity that emerges when it comes to the redistribution of economic benefits derived from this wealth of ideas and creativity. Within this context, the excessive forms of authorship through which architecture is commercialized reveal the way in which architectural identities are instrumental to capital. Capital uses these identities in order to fragment the common and to appropriate it for its own sake. Divide et impera is the way in which architecture as collective knowledge is appropriated and mystified by capital as the product of individual authors in the form of parades of iconic buildings. Against this situation, a commitment towards the common has to be directed at first towards its political acknowledgement as a productive force, as the core of architecture itself, and as the truly, quote, common ground of architecture. This acknowledgement implies a basic income for those who de facto produce architecture and that today live in a state of increasing economic and existential instability. Basic income would free cooperation among architects from the straitjacket of individuality individually driven offices in which collaboration is merely a force to support the individual signature. Such an economic reality would allow the evolution of the discipline of architecture to be autonomous from market constraints. A commitment towards the common also means that the production of architecture itself, in terms of forms, must acknowledge the pre-individual origin of any architectural form, instead of masquerading them with the pretension of novelty and originality at all costs. In order for these forms to make evident their common origin, they must exhibit their principium individuationis. An example of such architecture would be projects such as Le Corbusier's Maison Domino and Mises' skin and bones building technique. In these examples, the pre-individual datum of architecture, the industrial techniques that were necessary for their realization, is not hidden but fully exposed as the very image of architecture. This means that architectural language must be thought as a generic language that engenders singular forms. Only when architectural language assumes in its aesthetic appearance the reality of the common will it be a true manifestation of a potential architecture. In opposition to the enclosing of architecture as collection of individual expressions, a common architecture will be an architecture that in every singular manifestation of itself, in the form of a drawing, a building, or a text, will put forward its public form. It would thus be an architecture, as it was defined by the Italian critic Edoardo Persico, who, paraphrasing a famous passage from St. Paul's letter to the Hebrews, stressed the potential dimension of architecture as the, quote, substance of things hoped, the evidence of things unseen.